I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Hey, Kiki.
I am glad that's over.
You're glad that the Christmas is over?
Yes. Now we get down to the good stuff.
Yeah, our final episode of 2020. Usually, we would at the end of the year, we would do a big year-end review. So let's review all the good stuff that we want to remember in 2020. Now that that's over, we can just move on to something else. Kiki, this was your idea.
Yes, this is the movie that I watch every Christmas Eve to make it officially Christmas. I sit down in costume and watch this movie. I have a Tony costume from this movie that I made. And I sit down and I watch Die Hard. And it is officially Christmas when the Hans has dropped. We will say, if you missed the explicit tag on the episode, we are not censoring this episode. So if you have little ears in the room, go away now. Pause the episode, wait till the little ears have gone, because unlike most of our episodes, this one deals with an R-rated movie with, you know, adult things happening and adult words, and we might say some of them, so, you know, no little ears, you have been warned.
Yes. We love that some of our listeners like to listen to our show with their young ones, we appreciate it, but not this time, sorry.
This is a special episode just for the grown-ups.
But we are not alone in this one.
No, there is a third lurking in the ether. Will our mystery guest enter and sign in, please?
Hi! sorry, weird voice cracks. Hello! hi, it's Insane Ian. I'm here, and because I really love Die Hard.
Yeah, we see you walking, crawling through the vent there with the lighter.
Yes, it has filthied up my tank top. And speaking of being in costume, when I watched this last night, it was part of a Zoom stream with some friends, and both me and the person hosting it were also dressed as Tony.
Tony costumes for everyone.
Matt Doohan had his very official looking, you know, it's a gray sweatshirt with it written on. Now I have a machine gun, ho ho ho, in red. I am wearing the Christmassy version of that, which is a green sweatshirt with it stenciled on it like it's wool, with pictures of machine guns. You've seen the shirt on me before.
Yeah,
I've worn
I've
it in
seen
videos
it.
And stuff. So, but yes. And
my Tony costume is homemade. I just bought a gray sweatsuit, and I used, you know, red fabric pen to doodle it on myself.
I think that's what Matt did too. But I said when I said official, I meant it looked more official looking than mine, which is mass produced.
Authentic, you mean?
Authentic. That's the word I meant. I'm good with words. I'm a writer. You can tell.
If you've been listening to the holiday episodes, you do recognize Ian's voice from our holiday opening. He was kind enough to be our holiday announcer for that. So yes. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me do that. I enjoy being asked to be an announcer type person. I'm an announcer type person on many podcasts I'm not on. So...
And that's why we thought of you.
Yay. I have a voice that does
let's
things.
Let's get that guy on all that stuff that we don't do.
We've known Ian for quite a long time.
Yeah. You know, Tuesday and I used to have a Let's Play show for a while, so.
Yeah, and then COVID happened.
And Kiki and I have done songs together, and Hopefully we'll do some more at some point. And, you know, we all happen to be jurors this year on the Logan Awards. So.
Yeah. We talked about that a lot on the show, yeah.
Yeah, so thank you guys for doing that. Really appreciated that, because that makes my job as the chairman of the Logan Awards much easier. I don't have to do things except tell you guys what to do. It's fun.
Well, now we get to tell you what to do, and that is talk about Die Hard, which is a subject I know all three of us are just going to hate.
Oh my god, twist my arm. How can I do this?
Yeah, and it fits into our theme of a Disney podcast because, you know, Disney bought Fox.
Yep, and Die Hard is a Fox movie. In fact, the Nakatomi Building is the Fox corporate office. So, yeah.
Does Disney own the Nakatomi Building now?
I think that means Disney does own the Nakatomi Building now, yes.
I mean, News Corp still owns the Fox News Channel, so maybe? I don't know. But there is a Disney connection that this movie was, at least one of the drafts was written at the Disney studio.
Yeah.
Jeb Stuart, who's the writer on this, wrote the
one
initial
draft. Yes.
One of the writers on this movie was working for Disney at the time and wrote the first draft of this movie at the Disney studio. Yep. So there's your Disney connection.
Yep. It was brought over to Fox when Steven D'Souza was called in to update the drafts and do all the subsequent drafts after Jeb's.
And you're such a big fan. You actually wrote a song about Die Hard.
I did. Me and Bone Cage have a song called Die Hard Christmas, which is a parody of Little Drummer Boy / Peace on Earth by Bing Crosby and David Bowie.
Hans Gruber. Can it be? He is here for robbery.
It always comes back to David Bowie.
Yes, of course.
Everything comes back to David Bowie.
I mean, obviously. I mean, come on. So yeah, that one came out a couple of years ago, and there's a video for that on YouTube. If you search for Die Hard Christmas by Insane Ian and Bone Cage, that'll pop right up. That one's one of my more popular Christmas tunes.
All right, let's see what else can we get to, or unless you want to get into who's in this movie.
Yeah, we might as well talk about the cast.
Yeah.
The
man himself, John McClane himself, Bruce Willis, who at the time was not known as an action star.
No, this was his introduction into action movies. He was
moonlighting at that time.
Yeah, exactly. He was mostly known for comedies. He had the movie Blind Date and the TV show Moonlighting, and it was, you know, more a comedic bent, which he used to his advantage in this movie with a lot of the quips that he says, him improvising those. But this one was, you know, he wasn't the first choice for John McClane. He wasn't even the third choice for John McClane in this movie, but they went down the list and finally settled on Bruce for it, and a superstar was born, as well as an entire genre of the everyman action star.
Yeah,
let's talk about some of the people that this role was offered to that turned it down. You got your Schwarzenegger, of course, who was the main guy at the time.
Yep.
Sylvester Stallone,
of course,
turned it down. Harrison Ford, Mel Gibson, Don Johnson, Richard Dean Anderson, MacGyver himself,
turned
down this role. James Caan, even Clint Eastwood, who is kind of referenced in the movie in the cowboy riff.
My favorite one, however, is Frank Sinatra.
Because he technically
Frank
played
Sinatra
the character.
Was 77 years old. And what a lot of people don't realize is this movie is based on a book called Nothing Lasts Forever, or I think that's what the book is called. It's something like that.
It's Nothing Lasts Forever.
Nothing Lasts Forever by Roderick Thorpe, which is a sequel to his book The Detective. And the character in the book is not John McClane, it's John Leland. And when they made a movie of the first book, The Detective, Frank Sinatra played John Leland. And under contract, they had to offer the role to Frank Sinatra because this was the sequel.
It kind of reminds me of the whole situation with Batman Forever, where they had to offer the role of Two-Face to Billy Dee Williams.
Yeah. So Frank Sinatra, 77 years old in 1988, was offered the role of the lead in Die Hard, and of course turned it down.
Thing, though, is that Sinatra would have been the correct age for the character according to the novel.
According to the novel, yeah. But they change a lot from the novel, obviously changing the character name from Leland to McLean. The Holly character isn't his wife, but his daughter. I don't even think she's called Holly. I think, but that's
no. But her last name is Gennaro. She has married, and so her name was McLean Gennaro. And they kept that for Holly's maiden name.
Yep. Holly was thrown in because it's a Christmas movie.
It's a holiday movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leland is way more racist in the book too. So,
there's a little bit of racism in the movie as it stands, but it comes from the bad guys. So,
but at the same time, that's a very diverse group of villains. You've got Germans, you've got French, you've got Uli, who's your generic Asian henchman who's always playing a henchman in every movie. He was a henchman in Lethal Weapon. That Kurt Russell, Big Trouble in Little China. And then you've got, Theo. So, you've got a lot of diversity hires in the bad guy crowd, which is very progressive for 1988.
But the only one who's like, actually says racist things is Ellis.
Yeah.
Who is also a bad guy, just not part of the terrorists.
Yeah, well, but Ellis is just a dick.
He's a jackass, yeah.
Yeah, he's your 80s asshole. So
we got to talk about Bruce Willis was the reason my mother loved the movie because Moonlighting was like her favorite TV show at the time. So this Die Hard actually became a movie she loved.
Yeah.
My
folks too, actually. That's the reason they went to see it in theaters.
It's because your mom liked Moonlighting?
Well, they both liked the show Moonlighting. They watched it every week and they went to go see it when it came out in theaters and they were like, "Wow, it was a great movie, but it was nothing like what we expected." But my folks loved action movies. I watched tons of action movies growing up. I didn't watch anything rated R until I was well in my teens, but I was some of those goody-goody kids. Like, if you were watching a rated R movie in the living room, I'd run past with my ears closed so that I made sure nothing got into the... I wasn't corrupted by the overaged thing for me.
Living that rated G life, huh?
Yeah, living that rated G life, absolutely. References!
I kind of remember seeing this on TV when my mom was alive, and my mom was watching it on TV, but I think it was one of those, yippee-ki-yay mother father kind of cuts, where they
I love the TV version of the second one because it's yippee-ki-yay Mr. Falcon, and there is no Mr. Falcon in the movie at all, and that's what makes it so great.
And the dubbing doesn't sound anything like Bruce Willis.
No, they got a sound alike that sounds nothing alike him.
But I do remember seeing this when I was a kid, and slightly towards the end of her life there, I think she let me watch it with her on TV in an edited form. But the reason that I still love this movie to this day is because it has the glorious Alan Rickman playing our villain Hans Gruber.
And this really made him a star too.
It was his first Hollywood role. I mean, he was mostly a stage performer on the London West End before this, and he was, his career, as it were, as we know it, started with him in his 40s. So, don't give up hope, folks. You can start living your dreams no matter the age. But Alan Rickman really just dominates this movie as the calm, cool, and collected, yet vile thief, Hans Gruber.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that Rickman is really credited with bringing the intelligent and sophisticated villain into the action movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Action movies prior to this had, like, you know, a crazy scientist or a crazy politician, maybe, or just a crazy criminal. But it was always a crazy person.
Yeah.
The mustache twirling kind of villain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, the one who's driven by their insane ideas of what the world should be for them. And, you know, for this one, everyone assumes that they're terrorists taking over the building, but no, he's a lot more calculated than that.
And he's his plan is like three-dimensional chess.
Yeah,
his plan absolutely. Is complex enough that, nope, it basically... It would have worked exactly the way he planned it, except he didn't plan for McClane.
Yeah.
His plan was glorious, and if you kind of watch the movie and think, okay, if John McClane wasn't in the building, how would this have gone? He would have gotten away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, even
because
when the cops
FBI
come.
Because the FBI and the cops yeah. and the, you know, he planned it all, which is fascinating to me that this is a guy who... had thought of every piece of the puzzle except what happens if some chick invites her New York cop husband to the Christmas party.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, in fairness to Hans, not really something any of us think about when planning
well,
a heist.
We do so. Now because of this movie, but...
He set an example for years to
yes.
come.
Yes, exactly.
We're going to move on through the cast here with Bonnie Bedelia. And the funny thing that I noted is that we watched Home Alone earlier, which is also about one character sort of trapped inside a building trying to to get the better
Home
of criminals.
Home Alone is a Die Hard movie. Absolutely.
Yeah. And Bonnie Bedelia there is actually was born Bonnie Bedelia Culkin. She is Macaulay Culkin's aunt. Kit Culkin, who is Macaulay Culkin's father, is her brother. So
nice.
Little random fun trio. Connection. And, but much like Bruce Willis, I will say, much like Bruce Willis, the role of Holly Gennaro was given to almost every other actress in Hollywood before it ended up with Bonnie Bedelia.
I mean, Holly is almost more of a hero in this movie than John is, because she actually has to deal with Gruber for most of the movie.
Yeah.
And she keeps her head. You know, when everybody else in the building is screaming at gunshots and crying and everything, she is very calm and collected and keeps her wits about her.
She kind of has to in that role of an office boss, especially a female office boss in the 80s. Like, the moment you show any kind of, even today, the moment you show any kind of emotion, they're going to call you too emotional for the job, you know? So she kind of has to be cool, calm, and collected. And yeah. Of course, you know, she makes the quips about, you know, only one man can make a man that angry. And so she's dealt with John for however many years they've been married. So again, keeping her cool.
Well, not just that, but she's also, you know, a female CEO in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's shattering glass ceilings all the time anyway. And, you know, she's worked her way up through this company, through this male dominated primarily Japanese company. So yeah, of course, that's why she has to change to her maiden name, because it's a Japanese company, as they say in the dialogue.
Yeah. Rounding out the rest of the cast, we have Reginald Bell Johnson, who you remember as Carl Winslow from Family Matters.
Or the cop in Ghostbusters, or another cop in yet another... He gets cast as cops a lot, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because fat cops are funny.
Well, it's just, I think he got cast as one, and then it just kept going.
You know, you go with what you're good at, and he's good at playing cops, so.
Yeah. I mean, it might even be why the character on Family Matters was the cop, you know, it's like,
yep.
Oh, well. One other kind of fun little thing that a lot of people don't know, this movie is filled with kind of, hey, that guy, you know, so
yeah.
We're not going to go through all of them. But the one thing is that the big, beefy kind of Russian guy, Carl,
he's German in this.
German. Okay. He was Russian in real life.
He's Russian in real life. Yeah, it's Alexander Gudinov.
Yeah, who was a ballet dancer with the Bolshoi.
With the Bolshoi Ballet, yeah.
He was one of the greatest ballet dancers, and then he ran afoul of another one of the greats. he had kind of run in with Mikhail Baryshnikov, and Baryshnikov basically ruined his career as a ballet dancer.
That he passed away only a few years after this movie too, so
yeah, it was kind of a fascinating career he had after ballet. He moved to the U.S. During the Cold War as well. So, you know, he defected, I guess would be the correct term, to the U.S. And he came to Hollywood and he started being an actor. He ended up turning down any roles that really typecast him. He refused to take roles where he was a dancer. After Die Hard, he refused to take kind of action villain roles. But he
was still doing great kicks in that, so.
Yeah. He is an Amish man in Witness, the Harrison Ford movie.
That's right.
He was kind of a more comedic role in The Money Pit. Hmm. But yeah, unfortunately, he had a problem with alcohol and it led to his unfortunate and untimely death in 1995. So, but it was kind of interesting because I have watched some of his ballet performances. You can go on YouTube and look up his name and see a lot of his ballet. And he is a rather large man, but when he is dancing, like, it's like he weighs nothing at all. He gets the height on some of those leaps and just, he does these twirls that it's just like, you know, I've not seen like female ballerinas, you know, do spins kind of that tight and beautiful and stuff, and he's like four times their size. So really, really impressive man, and shame he died so young. Very interesting film career though.
Yes, indeed. And you know, there's a lot of character actors that kind of fill out this cast too, and you know, he became kind of a character actor, you know, later in his career, but we can't talk about this cast without talking about the greatest 80s villain ever, and I mean Dickless, aka William Atherton, who as Thornburg in this movie, because he was just that quintessential blonde 80s punchable face, and he did that in Die Hard. He's the EPA guy, aka where he gets the name Dickless in Ghostbusters, and he's the foil to Val Kilmer in Real Genius. You know, the guy had a pedigree of being just this smarmy 80s asshole, and plays it, of course, to perfection because of that.
Said the quintessential 80s villain, I actually thought you were going to talk about Paul Gleason.
we'll get to the bull with the horns in a minute, but
well, Paul Gleason, who plays our deputy chief. Police chief
Dwayne
here,
Robinson.
He's the principal in Breakfast Club.
Yes.
That causes the kids all the, and when I think of quintessential 80s villains, that's kind of what I think of.
like you guys are saying, this is a literal who's who of 80s actors. Hey, that guy, you know.
Yeah, you know, like I said, the actor who plays Uli, you see him as a henchman in tons of 80s action flicks. So.
Yeah, and Robert Davi is in this too as Big Johnson.
Big Johnson, the first Agent Johnson, not Special Agent Johnson.
Yeah.
That has to be a Johnson and Johnson joke. That's how I always thought that.
It was just kind of a joke that they both had the same name. Actually, an Agent Johnson also appears in Die Hard 4.
Well, I mean, of course they're called Big Johnson and Little Johnson, so of course there's a penis joke there.
Yeah, exactly.
it's obvious in the script, although they're not referred to by Big and Little in the dialogue. It's only in the credits.
No, it's just only in the credits, yeah.
This is Agent Johnson. No, the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that little line in the movie.
And, for another Ghostbusters reference, one of the terrorists is Viggo the Carpathian.
Oh, yeah. He is.
Yeah, Von Homburg is plays James in this. And he doesn't have a whole lot of lines. All his lines are in German. But he's one of the guys who's moving the rocket launcher. The missile launcher in the sequence with the RV. You see him in and out of other scenes. He's pulling people from the rooms when they first take over the 30th floor. That's Viggo the Carpathian. Doesn't sound like Max von Sydow, obviously, because Max von Sydow didn't do his voice like he did in Ghostbusters 2. But
yeah. Let's kind of get into just kind of rambling discussions about the plot.
yeah, if you haven't seen Die Hard at this point.
Yeah, pause and go watch it. What are you listening to us ramble for? This is an amazing movie. Go watch it now. When you're done with that, come back and listen to us ramble about the plot.
Because clearly we know a lot about it and love it a lot, so.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing to me is that it is so weird and kind of sad to watch a pre-9/11 movie.
Yeah.
To watch this after 9/11 really changed the way this movie hits.
Absolutely. It's a, you know, things happening in a big tall building, people making emergency calls on emergency lines and being considered pranks. Just the fact of terrorists.
Well, even saying the word terrorist, you know,
it's kind of taken on a whole new meaning, like a weightier feeling to that word.
Yeah, if you called the cops, I don't care if it was a prank, but if you called the cops and uttered the word terrorist, that building would be swarmed with every bit of hardware that they had.
Yeah, absolutely.
There'd be tanks outside that building. There would be helicopters circling in the sky constantly. Every news camera would be on it.
Yeah.
And later they might find out it was a prank. But if you want to get the cops somewhere, that's, you know, the way to do it these days.
Yeah.
But even things like at the start of the movie, John McClane is on, you know, coming in on a plane, and he's got a gun on his hip.
Yeah.
And yeah, the guy sees his gun, and he's like, oh, it's okay, I'm a cop. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. A guy just carrying an open weapon on a plane.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
Can't do that no more.
Oh, simpler times.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure you should have ever been. I mean, we talked about we talked about Indiana Jones. He just, like, throws a loaded weapon in his carry-on luggage.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's, you know, just like, you know, oh, don't worry about it. You know, like, he doesn't have his badge or anything. The guy doesn't, nobody asks to see ID. It's just, oh, yeah, a white man with a loaded weapon. I'm sure that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Moving on. So let's get to the crux of this movie, the relationship between John and Holly. So as we've mentioned, Holly is a high-ranking official in the Nakatomi Corporation, to the point where she kind of reports directly to the boss, the owner of the company.
Yep.
And that's kind of upsetted John, because, you know, he's the cop. You know, a cop is a man's job. It's a hard-working job, and he's kind of being undermined by Holly, in his mind at least, that Holly is successful. And at the beginning of the movie, he kind of goes that he's supportive of her. Hey, she had this job that turned into a great career, and it moved her out here, and I'm a cop in New York. And the question gets brought up, but it's never really answered by John, is, well, why didn't you come to New York, to L.A. with her? Why did you stay in New York?
Well, he kind of addresses that to a point, because, you know, Argyle actually asks him that, you know. Argyle, the limo driver who's taking him to the Nakatomi building, actually asks, why didn't you come out here with your lady? And he's like, well, I'm a cop in New York. I had open cases there that I couldn't leave behind. He's dedicated to his job. In much the same way that Holly was dedicated to her job to go out to L.A. to do her job. Taking their two children, Lucy and John Jr., with her to L.A. And has been out there for 6 months now doing this job and advancing in this company, getting so high as to be basically under the owner of the company. So they slightly address it. And of course, you know, since they're patching their marriage, spoiler alert, in the second movie, he's moved out to L.A. So,
yeah. But, you know, by the time we get to the third movie and the fourth movie.
Yeah. It's okay. A lot of stuff.
That's a lot of stuff happens.
Yeah, the thing is that Holly kind of foreshadows what would happen in the later movies in this one, because he's like, you know, why did you take the job? Why did you move? You couldn't, you know, and she kind of suggests that it wasn't all about the job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I mean, the job may have been the impetus, but she makes it sound like things weren't great beforehand either.
Exactly. I've discussed this movie on a other podcast that I used to do called IP Consultants, where we talk about the franchise, and that's the one thing about this movie that is undone by the other movies, is by the end of this movie, John has grown as a person, and, you know, he, you know, it's basically A Christmas Carol, just with an action movie shell. You know, he discovers the true meaning of Christmas and shouldn't be selfish about himself and wants to be giving and more caring about his family and their needs and et cetera. But all of that is undone by the other movies. You know,
and it kind of had to. If you're going to do a sequel, it kind of has to. That's the sad part about sequels, is that you have to put a situation where the character needs to learn the same lesson again.
And not necessarily. Sometimes it's, you know, good sequels are the growth of that character beyond that point. But because he had such an exponential growth in this movie, it made it difficult to, they had to regress the character instead.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that's kind of why that among the fans, the Die Hard 2 is kind of considered the good sequel. And then everything after that kind of, because Die Hard 2 does kind of keep that growth.
Well, Die Hard 2 keeps some of that growth,
yeah.
As far as the character development, and it is the one of the weaker sequels, because it's basically just, as sequels of that time did, just completely retreading all of the plot points and focal beats from the first film. It is the first film in a new coat of paint.
And for 80s movies, especially in early 90s movies, that worked.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was kind of worn on my belt, you know, as was the trend at the time.
You know, give us more of the same. Now today, when you're just redoing the same movie all over again, the audience tends to not favor that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
They want the continued adventures. Where are these characters going, instead of the same thing over and over again?
Yeah, and that's what they, you know, brought forth with 3, 4. We don't like to talk about 5. But yeah, that's kind of what the franchise did. But the more they did that, the more they moved away from the core character of what John had become in the two previous movies. So,
yeah, I mean, I know that I at least have always kind of liked the second one, because honestly, I'm like, well, you know, yeah, it's formulaic, but it's a formula that really works.
And it's a formula to the point that they even said it at Christmas too. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and I honestly, I kind of like all the sort of Die Hard on a blank movies.
Well, that's what this movie spawned. That's the thing. It had that formula of one guy, one average guy against the unspeakable odds that, you know, Die Hard on a blank became what this movie spawned. You know, you had Die Hard on a Boat, which was your Steven Seagal Under Siege movie, or Die Hard but in an NHL arena, which is Sudden Death with Sudden Death with Jean-Claude Van Damme. And then, you know,
Speed is Die Hard on a bus.
Exactly. Speed was Die Hard on a bus, but it was written to be a Die Hard movie.
Yeah. Air Force One, which is Die Hard but on Air Force One.
Yeah. Die Hard on a plane, but specifically on Air Force One. Yeah. You had a glut of those movies coming out after this. You know, so it's the original, it's the originator, often duplicated, but never quite surpassed.
Yeah.
This is the quintessential 80s action movie. As I was watching this movie, and I see this movie quite a few times, it just comes out like, this is when you think 80s action movie, like, this is it.
Yeah. And but it came in at the tail end of the 80s too. So that's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, when I think 80s action movies, you think more of the beefy muscular dudes kicking ass. Like, you've got
Predator,
Schwarzenegger's
like that,
Commando, or you've got Stallone and Cobra. Those are the 80s action movies most people think of. This is where the trend changed. This is where the modern day action movies came in, where it's a guy, kind of a regular looking guy. He's not super muscular. He's fit. He's not, you know, ultra dad bod either. He's just kind of in that middle ground where he's a healthy dude, but he's an average dude. And, you know, that's kind of like where the shift went from your muscular He-Man sculpted from the gods kind of guys to, oh, look, Bob from down the street who takes his trash out every day and, you know, occasionally walks around in a tank top. He's an action guy now.
Which is good, because it gives the audience a surrogate, a more relatable surrogate.
Absolutely.
But it also led to bad trends in real life of people trying to become the real life action hero.
Yeah, everybody wants to be a John McClane.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be the guy who saves the day if the insurmountable odds, because he's an everyman and I'm an everyman. Yeah. Although you don't hear about it too horribly much, thankfully, but it's definitely, you know, it can be perpetuated that way.
Which is pretty much them going with John McClane in the movie, how Gruber says, you know, you watch too many cowboy movies as a kid. And it's like today you have people who watch too many action movies as a kid and in the same position as McClane, but not learning the same lessons.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing to me, though, is that there's a lot of stuff that plays differently in this movie now because of modern perceptions. Like, there's even some stuff that watching it last year at Christmas, you know, I watch this every Christmas Eve, but there's even stuff that, like, last year at Christmas, it didn't hit me the same way as it does this year.
Yeah.
And particularly the fact of who John McClane and Al Powell are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're cops.
Yeah. And that's,
and in the 80s, that was like, you know, up on a pedestal.
Yeah, cops were the hero characters. Now, it's
more complicated. Difficult.
It's a little more complicated. I mean, I've been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine recently, and Andy Samberg's character Jake Peralta is a huge Die Hard fan. to the point that there's an episode where they're in LA and he stops by the Fox building and has to take a picture at every corner inside the building because, oh, this is where John threw the guy out the window. Take a picture with me. It's very funny. But he's a huge Die Hard fan, and even that show, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, with its Die Hard-loving main character, is kind of reestablishing the whole cop theme, considering the past year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is that we gotta talk about Al's backstory.
Yeah!
Yeah.
Al murdered a child.
Well, we don't know if he killed him. He just says, shot a kid.
Because he
held a toy gun, and as Al says, it was good enough for him, and he shot.
Yeah, you know, it was dark, I couldn't see, it was a toy gun, looked real enough, is what he says.
Yeah.
And
after, like, you know, after other, you know, we've had this exact scenario.
Sadly, yes.
In the media, you know, a little black kid with a toy gun, they don't specify the race of the child. In the film, but you know, we've had little black kid with toy gun murdered by cops. You know, it's
little kid with a toy truck murdered by cops because they thought it was a gun.
Yeah, man with a cell phone murdered by cops because they thought, you know, I mean, it's
a lot of shoot
if you were
first
to write
this
movie today, it would be considered cliche to give Al this story.
Yeah, but we're quickly learning that the cliches exist for a reason.
Yeah,
and honestly, they did exist in the 80s as well. It's just they weren't really publicized by the media to the point that everybody knew.
Well, I mean, media...
It was more romanticized.
Yeah, and media is just, you know, the transference of information is just so much faster now. Things get around a lot more easily than they did then. It happened probably with the same amount of frequently. You just didn't hear it because the internet wasn't really a thing.
Yeah, you didn't have normal people reporting on it.
Exactly.
You had, you know, somebody at a network deciding whether or not it made good news.
Exactly.
The thing, though, is that it kind of, you know, it does complicate the movie, watching it from a modern sense, because you start to wonder, like, you know, the movie sets it up, things like, well, you can't blame John for Ellis's death. Ellis was a complete prick, you know? It's like, but at the same time, like, the novel makes this more clear, strangely.
Yeah.
The novel makes it very clear that if John had just stayed hidden, fewer people would have died.
Yeah. Admittedly, he does try to save Ellis, but... It's put in that scenario where there's no winning, no matter the outcome.
Yeah, he says, you know, I don't know him. Don't hurt him. I don't know him. And that itself has become a cliche in action movies where the hero character will feign ignorance of knowing someone just to get that person out of the way.
Well, John does it twice in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when he meets Hans for the first time and Hans is pretending to be Bill Clay, John doesn't say, I'm here with my wife. He says, I got invited to the Christmas party by accident. Because he already knows that Hans is Hans, not that he's Bill Clay. Mm-hmm. That's one of the tells that, you know, on a second or third or whatever watch, you realize, oh, he already knew that Hans was Hans. There's a deleted scene that it shows exactly how he already knows, but... him saying that shows that he's not giving up any information about himself or about who Holly is because he knows that Hans isn't who Hans is saying he is. He knows he's not Bill Clay.
Even without the deleted scene, you get that he's a cop and he's been at it for a while. The idea of he can spot a fake ID no matter how well it's produced.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's just that good of a cop that he can tell.
He has that certain set of skills. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not even until later in the movie where the news crew go to Holly's house and interview the children where Hans puts it all together.
Exactly.
Which is why the newscaster really deserves to get punched in the face at the end of the movie.
Yep. But, you know, that was a whole tangent. Sorry about that. Back to what we're
saying. That's fine.
We're all about tangents here.
It's fine.
The 80s
cliche.
The thing that I...
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go.
I was going to say about the 80s cliche of drug use. A lot of cocaine in this movie.
And not all of it goes to Ellis. My favorite part of Ellis's just unashamed and unabashed cocaine use is when he's talking with Hans, Bubby, about giving John to him, and they bring him a Coca-Cola. He clearly asked them for Coke.
Yeah.
He clearly asked them for cocaine.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, can we get you anything while we're eating? And he's like, yeah, can I get some Coke? And they bring him a glass of Coca-Cola, and you're like, ah, yeah, that's clearly what he meant and what they heard, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the whole thing that, again, back to what we actually were saying is that, you know, it's one of those Kobayashi Marus. It was a no-win scenario. You know, there, no matter what he says in it, you know, is going to be a bad outcome for anybody involved.
And, you know, Ellis being a dick throughout his entire interaction with Holly and, you know, pretty much trying to hit on her, knowing that she's a married woman.
And I think that's really Ellis's motivation in that scene. He's not trying to give McClane to Hans so that the scenario, give them the detonators so that they can get the situation over with quickly. Ellis doesn't care about getting the situation over with quickly. Ellis wants John out of the way by any means. If that means that Hans going to kill John, that's great for Ellis. He can move in on Holly. That's why he says John is Ellis's friend at the party as opposed to Holly's, because he doesn't want anything to happen to Holly either.
It's true.
Ellis isn't there thinking with his dick.
Yeah, and the other thing is that even if John survives the scenario, Ellis in his mind is then the hero.
Yeah,
he's
exactly
the one that got it over quickly.
I'm the one who rescued your husband, which you're estranged from anyway, so maybe I can move in here.
You kind of mucked things up, and maybe he got our boss killed. You weren't there. You don't know. You know, it's like that
exactly
kind of thing. You know?
And
exactly
as far as Ellis is concerned, John is only there for Christmas. So he's hoping by New Year's he can slip right in there.
Exactly. So, you know, Ellis has his ulterior motives. All of them are in Holly's pants.
Yeah. Yes. The thing that, you know, we talked before about the book making it very clear that John gets a lot of people killed by complicating the situation. In this one, though, they give that to various other external characters. It may not be John necessarily that gets innocent people killed, but it is the action of people outside the situation trying to make it better.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have
Ellis tries to make it better for his own, you know, whatever motive he has, but he is trying to kind of get the situation resolved in one way or another.
And you have the reporter who screws things up. Yeah, the reporter screws things up, almost gets Holly killed because he wants a story. You have the FBI screwing things up because as one of the Johnson says, he's having Vietnam flashbacks.
Yeah.
Saigon.
Just wants
to
get back into
a war.
The war.
Yeah, and he, you know, 20-25% of the hostages tops might get killed in them shooting everything on the roof. Yeah, great.
And both FBI guys are okay with that, because even the young one that wasn't in the war is like, yeah, I'm cool with that. That sounds good.
They already have their story set to tell the news and make themselves look like heroes.
The SWAT commander leading the RV. Saying, oh, no, they're almost in. You send them in there. And he's like, no, let us pull them out. They're going to get murderized from giant rocket launchers.
Yeah.
Yeah. The cops were warned, you know, both McClane and Al warned them, like, hey, if you try to breach, they're much better armed than you think they are. This is not going to go your way. And instead of being like, well, can you give us information on how well armed they are? They just barrel right in and they get a lot of cops killed.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, the only two hostages we see killed are the head of the Nakatomi on the site, Takagi, and Ellis.
Ellis, yeah.
And Ellis is kind of responsible for his own death.
He is. Yeah.
So, you know, most of the actual casualties are sort of the people who are mucking it up.
Yeah. I think it's Al says, you know, they have the terrorist playbook and they're playing right into their hands. And it's like you said, Gruber is like three steps ahead of the cops and the FBI. He's already saying, oh, well, they're going to do this, which is going to make us do this. Even going the genius part is when the FBI cuts the power grid.
Yeah.
Because they've been trying to, I mean, for those of you who haven't seen it, Gruber's plan is to get these bonds that are in the basement safe of the building that is closed by an electronic lock, which they cannot open by just cutting the wire. So they need the entire power grid shut down, which is the point of the entire thing in the first place.
Yeah, because
that's why they want the cops there.
That's why they want the FBI there, because the FBI will go through the playbook of turning off the power, letting them sweat it out, and then exactly. Actually, the version that I watched last night was actually the extended edition, which has a whole 13 seconds of extra footage. wow. And it's basically an extended part on that sequence where they first turn off the power specifically just to that building, which does not open the time lock. And so Hans says to Theo, all right, that's not enough for the power. Annoy them. And he goes, annoy them? Annoy them. Oh, you mean piss them off. So Theo rewires something to give the building power again, which causes them to shut off the entire grid on the block.
I watched this on, of all things, HBO Max. Because I want to see Wonder Woman on Christmas Day.
Right. But yeah, I you know, that was on the original, like, special edition DVD. That's not on the Blu-ray that's available now, for whatever reason. Yeah, that was only on, which is why I still have the DVDs. But that was the version that was shown at the thing that I was watching yesterday, too, so.
To me, one of the more interesting things is that we talked about the everyman, but it's a little bit different in the sense of John McClane is usually thought of as the first action hero who bleeds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, he takes a beating in this movie.
Yeah. We're used to seeing, at least in the 80s, we were used to seeing action heroes covered in blood, but it was never their blood.
It was never their own blood.
Yeah. And John McClane is covered almost entirely in his own blood, you know?
He gets cut. He gets shot. He's walked on glass and his, you know, feet are bleeding everywhere and bandaged. And yeah,
he's got to have some massive bruises around his midsection from taking that fall off the building with the fire hose wrapped around him.
Not just that. His arms should probably be ripped out of their sockets when he goes through the elevator shaft and misses the one catch to crawl through the vent. There was a video put out by, I think it was the Honest Trailer channel. I forget the name of that channel now. But the trailer that does the channel that does the Honest Trailers, they used to do a series to see the survivability of movies. To see, oh, would this have actually killed a person, or could you live through this? And they did the first Die Hard movie, and John McClane should have died like four times in that movie.
I think
it's like way more than that, actually. They did the first movie, and then the second episode, they did movies 2 through 5. And, you know, throughout the whole series, how many times John McClane would have actually died. But in the first movie, he would have died from a lot of different things already in that movie. Like, blown out eardrums, cracked ribs, broken arms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the amount of stuff that happens to him is still impressive in this movie, but so much more would have happened to him in reality. So,
well, the thing is that in reality, Bruce Willis almost died doing just stunts. The quote unquote safe version of all this stuff. He did suffer permanent hearing loss And there was one part where they miscalculated. He was supposed to it was that stunt for the top of the building where the top of the building blows and he jumps off with the fire hose. But they did it with him jumping off of a building into a giant airbag, a smaller building, you know, a couple of stories into a giant airbag. And
Sure.
they had explosive charges go off in the distance behind him, and they miscalculated. And the force of the explosions pushed him too far out, and he almost missed the airbag. He
Oh,
landed
geez.
on the very edge of the airbag. So yeah, he almost died, and for a second the crew thought he had. Because you are
No.
not meant to land on the edge of the airbag, you were meant to land in the middle of the airbag.
You know, the softer part.
Yeah. So yeah, there was a moment where they thought they had killed their star. So
Whoops.
yeah.
You want to talk about outside forces affecting it's kind of twofold. The outside forces affecting the story and McClane affecting the story. Carl and Tony. How the infamous "Now I have a shotgun, ho ho ho" shirt with Tony being killed and then Carl saying "Screw the plan, I'm going after revenge." And
Yeah,
if
because
Tony
they were
if
brothers.
yes, I understand that. That's his brother, but if Carl had kept the cooler head and maybe saved, you know, listened to Gruber, maybe the plan would have still gone unsuccessful. But then Carl had to go for revenge.
Yeah, he
Yeah.
wanted blood. It's what he started screaming about from the second that he found out Tony was dead.
Yeah. You know, they didn't expect any of their crew to die in this. They had a
Yeah.
plan. You know,
Well,
maybe we'll kill the hostages, but you know, we are going to be the ones who are going to live through this. We're the ones who are going to make money. None of us should be dying, especially not my brother.
the interesting thing is the way Hans had planned it out, there was very little actual physical risk for the members of his crew.
Yeah, Takagi was probably going to be the only
Casualty.
casualty in his plan.
Well, I think their plan was to murder all the hostages by sending them to the roof. So the
Yes, obviously.
hostages were always going to die, but the idea was send the hostages to the roof. We stay down below. By the time they're finished sorting through the body parts, they'll realize that we escaped through the basement.
Yeah, exactly. In the ambulance that we had in the truck that you don't see when we walk out of the truck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not a bad plan. You know, if they don't know exactly how many hostages are in there and they start piecing together body parts and stuff, it would take forever to realize that,
Yes.
wait a second,
We've
we
got too
have
many hip bones and
accounted.
not enough head bones.
Yeah. And plus they'd be dealing with, like, you know, dead people in the helicopters, and you know, I mean, there would have been a lot of casualties at that point, but there was no reason for anybody on this crew to ever expect any really kind of pushback. Maybe if the front door guard at the beginning had a gun,
Yeah.
there might be a little, you know, oh, if they can get to their guns quick enough, and that's why they came in pretending they were supposed to be there, you know, like get close enough and shoot him before he realizes what happens.
Yeah.
But that, you know, nobody expects anybody to be packing at a corporate Christmas party. They never expected the cops to get into the building, which the cops never do. So, yeah, that's Carl's reaction is kind of, you know, you told me this was a safe job. You
Exactly.
told me that there was no risk here. I brought my brother along. You got my brother killed. The fact that he didn't just murder Hans at this point is kind of impressive.
And technically, Tony's death is an accident
Yeah.
because he's McClane is just trying to choke him out, knock him out. It's Tony that's firing around and trying to hit the walls and get him off him that they break through the door and fall down the stairs, and Tony breaks his neck.
Yeah. The rest of McClane's kills are intentional, though.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a kill or be killed situation.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I mean, I have no ethical qualms with with using force to save the life of innocent people or to save your own life. Yeah. I mean, you know, to be honest, all of McClane's kills in this movie are absolutely justified. But it's the first one was, you know, the guy did say, you know, hey, cops have a code. You can't just murder me.
Yeah.
And then McClane does attack him, does use force, but you're right. He tries to use non-lethal force at first.
At first. Once Tony is killed, it all bets are off.
Yeah.
It's force all the way.
Yeah. Which at that point he no longer has the element of surprise.
Yeah.
So he plays it up, you know, now I have a machine gun, ho ho ho. And it's just the nonchalant way Gruber just says, tell Carl his brother's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really do think Hans is probably a sociopath.
Yeah.
Probably. Because he lies so easily.
And so quickly.
Yeah, and so quickly, he shows no emotion when any of his people are killed, except for the fact that his plan hasn't. You know, it's all about him. You know,
the one
this
time
is my plan.
The one time he's rattled is when Holly calls him a thief.
Yeah, but at that point, he gives the narcissist response, like, yes. I'm an excellent thief. You know.
Yeah.
Don't just call me a common criminal. I am the top tier criminal, thank you. But once again, it's a very narcissistic, sociopathic kind of response.
Even his quote about Alexander, he's misquoting there.
Yeah.
You know, he's saying the quote that is supposed to work for him in his situation, but he's misquoting it and screwing up the meaning of the quote about Alexander and all his worlds, nothing left to conquer.
And then he brags about it.
Yeah.
You know, he turns to Takagi and is like, oh, the benefits of a classical education. You know, it's like...
John Phillips, London.
You know.
Well, that's the thing about Gruber, though, because he says, you know, in the opening of the movie, who said we were terrorists? But at the same time, he's from the Volksfrei movement, which, you know.
Yeah.
And
they
he's talking about other terrorists
yeah.
in a positive fashion. So the assumption is valid.
But they also say that he's been excommunicated from that terrorist organization.
Yeah, exactly. So but at the same time, he was part of it. So. Yeah. Make of that what you will.
When you're too extreme for terrorists, that says a lot about you.
Yeah, exactly.
But the idea is, you know, he was part of the Volksfrei, but he got kicked out because they found him too violent.
Yep.
Which means that he wasn't in the Volksfrei for any kind of political ideology.
No, he just wanted to be violent.
Yeah. He wanted to blow stuff up. And when that didn't work out for him, he became a criminal. So, you know, it's, I think that honestly, Ellis, for all his faults, does peg Hans correctly when he calls him Eurotrash. I think that Hans, as brilliant as he is, and honestly, his plan is brilliant, and he is very slick in the way he carries it out. He is not the kind of educated high society man he wants people to think he is. And I think Ellis immediately is like bullshit recognizing bullshit, you know? Like,
yeah. Let's talk about the obvious one, the one that the joke that everybody makes of John taking off his shoes and how that is called very early in the film.
Well, it's a brilliant setup, I think. It's a brilliant way to establish an Achilles heel for our hero character. You know, it's him, as he says himself, better than being caught with your pants down. He's given a way to deal with flying because he's not great with flying, but you go to your hotel room, you take your socks and shoes off, and you make fists with your toes on the carpet, and that's supposed to calm you. And he tries it, and it works. And then he's unable to get his shoes on again from that point because the terrorists take over the floor. But that's a great way to both hinder and help him in his situation. Without his shoes on, he's able to move relatively silently through a lot of the floors because he's in bare feet. He's not making a lot of noise when he walks. But it also becomes a hindrance because they shoot the glass and, you know, end up cutting his feet because he's barefoot the whole movie.
And a lot of people make the question, well, why didn't he take the shoes of any of the terrorists he kills? They answer that pretty quickly, as they all have smaller feet than him.
Yeah, yeah, you know, he tries to take Tony's shoes.
Or he doesn't have time.
Or he doesn't have time because he's in the middle of running away from people. But, you know, he used Marco to throw at Al Powell out the window, didn't have a chance to grab his shoes before he shoved him out the window. He tries to grab Tony's shoes, and he says, naturally, the one terrorist has feet smaller than my sister's. So yeah, it's a whole lot of trying to get shoes and not really succeeding. And yeah, it is on his mind. It is something that he's trying to correct, but at the same time, it's still helping him somewhat running through the halls barefoot, and they're not hearing that.
I think that one of the cooler things in the movie is that it does have a lot of gunfire and a lot of explosions and a lot of action, but every single one of them is very grounded in reality.
Yeah.
There's a reason things are blowing up. It's not just like, oh, somebody shoots a tire off a car and the car just randomly explodes. You know? Yeah. It's like,
that'd be the later movies.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. The later movies do fit into that of, like, things just need to explode for no reason. But in this one, things explode because they would explode in real life.
Yeah, I mean, the later movies also kind of abandon the everyman thing, and McClane is basically a superhero. So, but, you know, we're talking about this one. And this one still runs into the trope of not a lot of people reloading. There is still reloading in the movie, and there is calls of, you know, I'm reloading, cover me, or John running out of bullets, or what have you. But there are also machine guns that are firing that have way more bullets than those guns would have. So there is a notice of the realism, and still not quite a 100% adherence to the realism, too. Just enough realism to have the stakes be high enough.
Yeah.
Well, and also, though, I mean, not a lot of average people know exactly how many bullets those particular I mean, now it's like, well, you can just Google it or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the time, most people in the 80s only knew machine guns from movies. Mm-hmm. You know, you never really came into contact with them unless you had some very specific employment, you know? But if you would just ask your normal moviegoer, like, well, how many bullets can you shoot out of a machine gun before you have to reload? 200. I don't know. You know? Yeah, so yeah. I think that's a bit more understandable. But they do show things like the smaller handguns, which people might be acquainted with, you know, at home. They do show that he runs out of them. He throws them away. He gets a new gun. You know, he's not just using one gun with infinite bullets the entire movie, which I love.
I do want to do a little bit of a sidebar here, because the scene is played for laughs is the newsroom with the very stupid anchorman getting countries wrong, and yeah, they're interviewing the psychologist on hostage situations, and he's going on and on and how, you know, if after a certain amount of time, the hostages will empathize with their captors and blah, blah, blah. After they've already killed Ellis, dragging his body through the building for everyone to see, it's like, while in certain situations you might be right, they're clearly not trusting these people after they murdered their own coworker, whether he was a dick or not.
The interesting thing is that this plays differently now than it did then, if you know anything about what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
You you know, he says the thing about Helsinki, and the guy goes, Sweden, and then he goes, well, Finland, you know.
Yeah, and it's actually Stockholm.
Well, the thing is, he's
basically talking about Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
Yeah, which sometimes gets mistakenly called Helsinki Syndrome, which is, it's a thing, you know, you were talking about Hans saying the wrong thing. They both kind of do. But the thing is that you're supposed to think that the Anchorman is kind of a goof and all. But the thing is we know now that the entire Stockholm Syndrome thing was made up by a journalist.
Yep.
And a police criminologist, because the police criminologist was trying to cover for the crimes of the police in that situation. It was a similar hostage situation, much like Die Hard. The police were coming in and mucking everything up, and one of the women on the inside was trying to negotiate for the safe release of everyone inside, including the hostage takers, because she knew once they got outside, like, okay, go chase the criminals all you want, I don't care, but if you try to take down the criminals while the hostages are still involved, we're gonna die. And honestly, when the police came in, the hostages were put at great risk. And so the idea, she went on TV and was like, hey, you know, why did the hostage, you know, why did they put the hostages at risk? And the cops had to come up with a reason why she would be saying all that. So they came up with Stockholm Syndrome, a crazy woman. Where have we heard that before? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the women are so emotional that she started to identify with her captors and seeing them as good guys and the police as villains. And she could only do that if it was a psychological disorder. So this scene plays doubly ridiculous if you actually know the entire story, because it plays out much like the story of Die Hard itself.
Mm, exactly.
Like, the police just put a bunch of people in danger that didn't have to be in danger because they didn't listen to reason.
And it's more in this movie as the feds don't care that the hostages are going to get killed. And let's kind of, since we talked mostly about the movie already, let's kind of get to the big climax, where, you know, Gruber's men are all pretty much dead, and it's just him and McClane and Holly. After the idiot newscaster went to their house.
And well, there are two terrorists who live through this. There's I think his name is either Fritz, it's not Franco, I think it's Fritz, who's the French speaking terrorist who John just knocks out at the end and goes, Holly! And then there's Theo, who just
knocks out
by Argyle. So those are the two that live through this event. So yeah, there are two, and they've recently made fun of that in a Die Hard battery commercial starring Bruce Willis as John McClane, Devereaux White as Argyle, and they brought Theo back as the villain in the commercial.
But I think that John is really, really, really smart at that point, because he sees the Christmas packing tape or whatever.
Yeah.
And tapes the gun to his back so that
how did he do that? How can you do that without another person helping you with that? They mentioned this in the Die Hard musical that just went streaming on YouTube called Yippee-ki-yay, Merry Christmas.
I was going to get to that.
which is a stage production here in Chicago. I watched that the night before I watched Die Hard. And they make a whole deal of, it is impossible for you to tape the gun to your back like that. Like, especially since it was on a tape gun. Like, the way to use the tape was to... It's a great moment of him hiding the weapon, but how did he do it by himself?
And also, What you don't think about unless you've like done a lot of cosplay or burlesque or something that might involve taping parts of your body.
Yes, exactly.
He is covered in sweat and blood and
Yeah, and
other
just
stuff.
grime and perspiration and his own blood and other people's bloods. There's no way that that tape would stick to him.
Yeah. Even in the best of circumstances, even if you like clean and prepare the area, it is hard to get an adhesive to stick to skin.
Yes, exactly. Depending on the type of adhesive.
Well, yeah. I mean, don't super glue your skin together, kids.
Yeah. Important safety tip. Thanks, Egon.
Yeah, important safety tips from ridiculous podcasts. Don't, yeah. But it's still. Despite the feasibility of it, it's still kind of brilliant that he thought ahead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm gonna go in there with one weapon. I'm going to pretend to put it down. I'm going to have another weapon hidden that I can then retrieve. But the thing I noticed in this watch through that I don't know why it never occurred to me before is that earlier in the movie, the terrorist on top of the table says, next time you have the ability to shoot someone, don't hesitate.
Thanks for the advice.
Yeah, and but the thing is, he doesn't take that advice because if he'd have come around and shot Hans the second he saw him, Hans could not have reached for his weapon in time to harm Holly. If he'd have just come around that corner, guns blazing, but he stands there and he's like, Hans, and he just stands there with the gun, waiting for Hans to slowly reach into his waistband and pull out a gun, reveal Holly. Like, you could have killed
That
him like
would
four
have been a
times.
very anticlimactic ending. We gotta have a big fine finale at the end of this movie.
I understand narratively why it's done, but in the moment, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I feel sorry for that one guy that said it, 'cause he dies by getting shot in the dick.
Yeah,
Oh yeah.
well, he mostly in the legs, but definitely in the in the grundle, and
In the dickle region.
yes. In the whole crotchal area.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not cozy, so.
And the guy before him in that scene that just his knees get blown out.
Yeah.
Like,
Well, I mean,
oh, that's the way to go.
there's a lot of leg gore in this movie. Everybody's getting shot in the legs in the sequence where in Shoot the Glass, McClane takes a guy's legs out and then he goes careening headfirst through a plate glass window.
Yeah. But yeah, that final scene with Hans, of course, is now iconic.
Yeah.
As Hans falls off Nakatomi Plaza.
You know, mostly because of Alan Rickman's performance, which was tricked on him. They were giving him a countdown of 1, 2, 3 before they dropped him from the system to have him fall onto an airbag when they were filming his face for the reaction. And they're like, all right, we're going to count to three and let you go. 1, and then they dropped him. So that expression on his face is genuine.
As bond bills fall from the top of Nakatomi Plaza onto the parking lot.
Yeah.
It's raining money.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, It's Raining Men and Let the Bodies Hit the Floor are the same song from different perspectives.
Yeah. The thing about that though is that I don't know if at the time Rolex put out a commercial based on that, but Rolex really should put out a commercial that's like, our watch bands are strong enough to hold a Hans. Because he is attached to Holly, apparently basically just by her watch
Yeah.
band.
But the thing is that that moment is so iconic of him falling in slow motion. And then, of course, the reaction from the ground of, I hope that's not a
Oh my
hostage.
God, I hope that's not a hostage.
And I think there was something you mentioned a long time ago, is that if you start the movie at a certain point on New Year's Eve, that Hans will fall at midnight.
Yes. You drop the
Well,
Hans for
yeah,
Christmas Eve.
I always say it's not Christmas until you drop the haunts. So I always do it for Christmas. I do it on Christmas Eve so that, you know, when he's dropped, it's already, you know, like midnight or something on Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. You know it's Christmas when Hans falls off in Nakatomi Plaza. There's shirts that say that.
Yeah. That is really, you know, we talk about this kind of jokingly now being a Disney movie because they bought it, but that is a Disney villain death.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Gaston right there.
Yeah, that's the classic, you know, villain falls to their death thing that Disney loved to do.
And much like a Disney movie, we never see impact. We just see the fall.
Yeah.
Yeah, he falls behind some trees.
And he's fallen 30 floors.
More than that, because I think, aren't they
the vault is on the 30th floor, because John goes to the roof and says, where's Holly? And the pregnant lady says, they took her to the vault. Where's the vault? It's on the 30th floor.
Yeah. Okay, so I had forgotten they were still at the door to the vault when that happened.
Yeah, because he was pulling the money, the bearer bonds, out in sacks. And that's why all the bearer bonds are falling from the sky after that sequence. Like snow in L.A.
Snow in L.A. is the cocaine.
Yes, well, it was the 80s.
That's when they drop the Ellis. You know, he hits the ground and there's just like a poof of white.
Which, speaking of Yippee-ki-yay, Merry Christmas, is how they kill Ellis. When they shoot him, he coughs and a puff of smoke comes out. And it's clearly the cocaine, because they play up the cocaine thing. It's an excellent parody. It's very, very tongue-in-cheek. It's very
There's
much...
a whole song about cocaine. That's
yeah, there, I mean, he sings a song about cocaine. The Christmas in California is the opening song. It's very tongue-in-cheek. It's meant to be corny as hell, and it absolutely is corny as hell. They don't use the names of the characters because they're like, we don't want to get sued and copyright stuff. But it's very much obviously Die Hard. It's the main character is Bruce McClane.
and Ellis is called Willis.
Ellis is called Willis. And when Holly introduces them, Ellis, this is Bruce Willis. Willis, this is Bruce Willis. Yeah, it's great. So,
it is on YouTube as we are recording this. I don't know if it'll still be there when this episode goes up.
Yeah, it's up for a limited time. It might be down, but they still have clips of the show on the Yippee-ki-yay Merry Christmas YouTube channel. So you can check out some of the clips.
I actually saw that live a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
It was amazing.
The interesting thing is that the idea of Die Hard as a musical is also used in Bob's Burgers.
Yep. Gene makes a Die Hard musical for his school musical production for Christmas.
Yeah, and I love it, and he turns it into a one-man show.
Yeah, so he plays back and everybody. Forth
between playing John McClane and playing Hans Gruber, and you know, this movie is so infinitely quotable.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the party, pal. You think I'm ordering a pizza?
Come out to the coast. We'll have a few laughs.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. And the Hans Booby. I love that.
Yeah, Hans Booby. It's Sprechen Sie Talk.
Yeah.
There's so many quotable lines in this movie. And also, because of that, and because of the other things that we mentioned, it's also so infinitely ripe for parody. You know, it became that cornerstone action movie. And it became that cornerstone Christmas action movie that Bob's Burgers did a Christmas episode with it.
Cleveland Show
did a straight parody of the movie. My favorite part of the Cleveland Show parody. Number one, it's called Die Semi-Hard, which is whatever. But the fact that they cast... You know how Eddie in the movie kind of looks like Huey Lewis from Huey Lewis in the News? They cast Huey Lewis as Eddie in the Cleveland Show version.
That's awesome.
So Huey Lewis is actually voicing the Eddie character. Because I was like, I was a kid. I was like, Eddie just, I think Eddie's Huey Lewis. And I found out later, no, it's not him. It's just, he just remarkably looks like Huey Lewis. I apparently wasn't the only person who thought that because the Cleveland show did it.
I always thought that Carl was Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought Dolph Lundgren was in this movie for the longest time as a kid because, you know, it looks like him.
And not everybody knows this, but Argyle is actually the kid who tries to steal the guitar off the wall in Ray's music store, in Ray Charles's music store in the Blues Brothers.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. Yeah, that's awesome. As we're recording this, last night on Colbert, on Stephen Colbert, he did a animated Christmas thing with Santa Claus and everything, and it had Die Hard references in it.
Of course. Because everybody who's involved in the production of Die Hard agrees that Die Hard is a Christmas movie. The writer, Stephen D'Souza, has said that he had put the Christmas elements in there on purpose to specifically make this a Christmas movie. The director, John McTiernan, just recently released a video, confusing as it is, claiming that Die Hard is a Christmas movie. Everybody says it, except Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis has always been a bit of a weird nut.
Well, especially of late. Bruce Willis has cashed in on being Bruce Willis, and most of his things now are direct-to-video movies where he's filmed maybe a day, gets top billing, and never leaves the one room his scenes take a place in.
Yeah, that is true. But you know, it has become this cultural thing of like, well, do you consider it a Christmas movie or do you not? And I am going to say this for anybody that's still like, why are they talking about Die Hard? It's not a Christmas movie. Okay. Christmas is about joy. Watch whatever makes you joyful.
An ode to joy, some would say.
Yes, it's an ode to joy. Thank you. But but in all seriousness, though, stop yucking people's yum. You know?
Absolutely.
Like, I don't care if they want to decorate their Christmas tree all goth.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care if they want to stay home and avoid Christmas at all. I was thinking recently about why I'm such a Grinch, and I think this is why. Like, it's not a time for joy. It's a time for certain circumscribed, socially acceptable joy.
Yeah.
And I don't go in for that, you know? So if you want to hold a Hawaiian luau for Christmas, maybe not this year, but, you know, when it's safe, do that.
People have their own Christmas traditions, and for some people, that's Die Hard. For a lot of people, I mean, there are many other podcasts and many other things that will argue to death on whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie or not. And honestly, everybody's got valid points about both. Like I said before, some can make it as a modern day allegory adaptation of A Christmas Carol, which it absolutely can be if you look at it from these certain perspectives. And also, some people say it's not a Christmas movie because it only takes place at it and it's not central to the plot. I don't agree with that. Obviously, the point is that the heist happens on Christmas, and parts of the heist couldn't have happened with the hostages unless it took place on Christmas because the Christmas party was there. They wouldn't have a 4th of July party at the Nakatomi building. It's just one of those, it is central to the holiday, it's central to the plot, the plot is based around it. But regardless of that, it's something that brings people joy this time of year, so why knock that?
Yeah,
if people want to say it's a Christmas movie, absolutely. Even before this was a discourse on the internet, I worked at a music store in high school, and my boss was filling an end cap one Christmas season with Christmas movies like White Christmas and you know, your other different holiday films. Put a It's a Wonderful Life up there, which honestly, technically, until recently, wasn't a Christmas movie either. And he asked me, he's like, I need more Christmas movies to put on the shelf here. Can you think of any? And I'm like, yeah, Die Hard and Lethal Weapon. Because in my household, those were Christmas movies. We watched them every Christmas. For and me, he looked Gremlins. At me like I had five heads.
Yeah, for me,
and
Gremlins.
This was early 90s.
Yeah.
But also, I don't even care if it has the tenuous connection of there's a Christmas tree in the background.
Yeah, which is every Shane Black movie.
Yeah. I mean, you want to watch Nightmare on Elm Street every Christmas? Do it. I don't care.
Yeah.
Does that make you happy? Does that bring your family together or make you feel a little bit of joy in the middle of darkness and snow and whatever else? Then do it.
If that's your holiday tradition, that's your holiday tradition. That's Christmas for you. Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang, Iron Man 3, and The Nice Guys are technically all Christmas movies. Because they've all got Christmas trees in them, and they're all by Shane Black, and Shane Black sets every goddamn movie at Christmas.
Yeah.
Except for the recent The Predator. It's like John McClane realizes in the movie, Christmas isn't about the trees or the decorations or the presents even. It's about being with your family and getting together and having that celebratory moment.
And dropping a terrorist off a building.
Well, yeah, true. But you know, everybody celebrates their own way.
And then facing his brother 7 years later.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think we kind of covered this as much as we can. Should we ask the question?
Does Die Hard have the magic? I'm going to say yes.
I mean, it spawned a whole genre of imitators. So yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and honestly, it's still part of the cultural consciousness now. Like I said, last night, as we're recording, Colbert used references to this movie.
They did a sequel as a commercial for a car battery for this holiday season. Yes!
You could see this as a prequel to Family Matters if you really wanted to.
Yeah. He moves out to Chicago, changes his name, and yeah.
He's in witness protection from
terrorists, but he's still a cop.
Exactly. It's fantastic. And you know, many of us, Kiki and myself, watch it every year for Christmas, and though movies have to have a certain amount of magic for you to want to revisit them so often.
Yeah, I don't think that you can really rewatch something that often if it's not magical in some way.
I mean, many people have described this as one of the most perfect action movies because there is not a moment in it that it's slow. There's not a wasted frame. There's not any moment that doesn't work in the film at its time. You know, there are moments now that you watch it and go, that really wouldn't work nowadays. But still, for it, you know, the thing in its time period, it is one of those movies that from end to end just works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're
going to agree.
That's Die Hard. 100%
stamp of approval on Die Hard. If you haven't seen it, get the little ones to bed and cozy up.
If you haven't seen it, we're sorry we spoiled every great moment in this podcast. But we did tell you to go listen to it first and, you know, come back to us. So that's on you, honestly.
And even when you know what happens, as we have proven, this is still just as fun to watch the 700th time as it is the first.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Ian,
yes,
as a first-time guest, you have a request.
Oh, so, do I?
So, yes, what would you want us to talk about in a future episode?
Well, I'm a big Disney fan. There's a lot of Disney stuff I like, a lot of Disney stuff I'm not super into, but one of my favorite movies growing up, he's kind of the black sheep of Disney movies because it went through so many changes before it finally was released, and a lot of different animators changed hands and everything. But one of my favorite movies growing up and still is one of my favorite Disney flicks is The Black Cauldron.
Ooh, that was the movie that the big changeover when Eisner came in.
Yes.
And Don movie Lewis that almost killed Disney Animation.
Yeah. And we will get to that in a few weeks' time because we have a couple of movies set up for January. We're going to do another theme month for January. We are dedicating January to classic Disney movies. When you think classic Disney, these are the movies that you kind of think about. And we are going to start 2020 going back to the beginning, the movie that started it all, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Yep. Can't wait. I mean, we're going back. We're going to do some original Walt era movies.
As long as you don't play the game Snow White and the Seven Clever Boys, you'll be fine.
Can we watch Snow White and the Seven Samurai instead?
Snow White and the Magnificent Seven.
Before we go, Ian, you got anything you'd like to plug? Where can the people find you more?
Oh, gee, I don't know. Yes, of course I do, because I'm shameless and on the internet. You can check out my music videos as well as my reactions to comedy music videos at youtube.com/insaneian. You can hear my own music there as well as on my Bandcamp page, which is insaneian.bandcamp.com. And you can also maybe support the things that I do by helping me make more music videos and other videos as well as songs at my Patreon, patreon.com/insaneian. And of course, following me on all the social medias at Twitter, Instagram, at insaneianb.
Insane Ian A was already taken.
Well, B, because my last name begins with B, so. But Insane Ian was already taken somehow, which was why I had to add the extra letter.
Find that person and deal with them.
I was going to say, there's 25 more of these guys.
By the time you get to Insane Ian Z, though, it really, you've really gotten the bottom of the barrel at that point.
All right, so join us next week as we go back to Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. In a few weeks, we will be covering the Black Cauldron. Go check out Ian's stuff. And
yippee-ki-yay and happy new year, motherfuckers.
Nakatomi, to spend my Christmas at her office party. A giant bear I'd bring to both of my kids. Switch to her maiden name is what Holly did. Celebrated the company's bid. Hans Gruber. Can it be? He is here for robbery. Hostages are taken. Terrorists are raiding the rooms. So I run and I hide away.
I have no shoes to wear, made fist with my toes. Tony down the stairs, broke his neck and his nose. Hit on an elevator right up above. Tied to a chair, he's dead and wearing a note. I have a gun, ho ho ho.
This is their idea of Christmas. I gotta be here for New Year's.
Sergeant Powell must be made aware. Welcome to the party, pal. The FBI will attack the doors, but they won't get very far.
Hansi told them to shoot the glass. We'll have a few laughs. Now Carl seems pissed at me, cause I killed his bro. Argyle's
Hans falls out the window. Thornburg gets a punch in the nose while Al shoots at Carl for me. John McClane saves the day.
Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic.
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic.
And of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it.